World. I'm Robbie Sinnott, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of Social Justice, Global Issues and Matters Multicultural. And you can email us at majorityworld@nearfm.ie. So on today's programme, we're going to be speaking to Abdelrahman Falsheikh Al-Sharif. She's actually a human rights activist in Sudan. At 5 o'clock, we're going to be speaking to Breed Smith. And Breed is going to be speaking to us about the unions after Irish Ferries and what sort of unions we should have. And at 5:15, roughly, if you're not listening on Friday, this will make different sort of sense to you, but we'll be speaking to a guy called Raj, and Raj is from Bangladesh, and he'll be telling us about some things that he's got going on right now. So at this moment, I don't know if he's going to be deported or has to leave the country, or whether he's finally got a contract to do something and he can stay. So we'll find out later on as well, but either way, there's a lot involved with this. But first, we have in the studio, and it doesn't happen often, but it's brilliant, we're very delighted to have DJ Daily, Y2K. Y2K was recently on holidays back in Nigeria. First of all, what were the changes you noticed when you went back to your place in Nigeria?
I don't know. Like, I left when I was really young, like, you know what I mean? So, it wasn't as if there were changes. It's just like, I just felt like, you know, it's a different world from here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not that maybe the things changed. Nothing really changed. You know, it was even worse than I can remember when I was there.
What sort of differences would there be between there and Ireland, for instance? What were the first things that struck you?
Number one, like, it was too warm for me. You know what I'm saying? Like, on the street. Like, when I first got there, I have to take off my clothes, and I was, like, walking down the street with no top on, and people were like, people would think you're mad. You know, they were telling me that people would think that I was mad because I was walking around the street with no clothes. So it was pretty warm, do you know what I mean? It was very, very warm.
Yeah,
just warmness, you know. Uh-huh. The weather is, you know, is different from here. And the way the people live, do you know what I mean? Like here now, in Ireland, before you can walk, you have to be maybe 16 or something like that. But over there, you know, there's no restriction. You see about 7-year-old kids selling maybe pure water on the street.
And is it hard to get running water, clean water?
It's a big problem for them. Like, people over there, they are used to drinking all those kind of water, but like, when I was going, the doctor advised me not to drink them water. So, like, I have to drink a special bottled water. Do you know what I mean?
Now, you can get Nigerian food in Ireland anyway, but was there any different food that you came across that you wouldn't have be used to, that Irish people wouldn't be used to?
Yeah, there were loads of food over there. There were loads of food that you couldn't find there in Ireland, like, that you could find there. Even if you find them here, you know, like pepper soup, like African people, we eat something like pepper soup, maybe fish soup or meat soup or whatever. But you could find it here, but the one you eat here is not as authentic as the one they sell over there.
And as well as that, you got extra strong Guinness in Nigeria.
No, I didn't drink Guinness while I was there because it would be too strong. Their Guinness was too strong for me, so I couldn't drink their Guinness over there. It's double the amount of alcohol percentage in the one we have here.
Wow.
So I couldn't drink Guinness.
And did you get your hands on any happening vibes, music sounds?
Yeah, I met loads of people because that was the primary reason why I went there. You know, I met loads of, you know, hip-hop artists, R&B artists, you know, record label owners, DJs, producers, you know, people from all walks of entertainment life. So I met loads of people. You know, in that aspect, Nigeria is growing, you know, in the entertainment aspect, like, people are growing, you know, they are doing big things now, and, you know, and all these guys, you know, they are making ends meet, you know, by being an entertainer. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I hear that hip-hop is really big in Nigeria, that people like Eminem and 50 Cent have got a big influence.
Yeah, people love Westlife over there. You will be surprised. Mm-hmm. You know, people love Westlife, Maxi Priest. You know, they are very advanced. The people are very advanced mentally. Do you know what I mean? Most of the people over there, they can even use computer more than myself.
So did you get traditional music in Nigeria? Like, it's less of it now because people are listening more to hip-hop and this type of music, you know? So But is there much traditional music still to be played there?
Yeah, there are loads of traditional music over there. Like, I got loads of traditional music over there. Because, yeah, like, for me to buy all those, like, a CD would cost about 10 euros, yeah. And over there, it cost me about 1 euro. Even less than 1 euro, do you know what I mean? So I got loads of traditional music and hip-hop, R&B, you know, mainstream hits. But it's just like, I have to look after what I play, you understand?
Yeah.
Because I can't be playing traditional music that people don't understand, you understand?
Yeah. So, yeah, dead right. And especially on the program that you do, which is Happening Vibes, which is a little bit different to traditional.
Exactly.
Which is a different kettle of fish altogether.
Exactly.
But I suppose what we'll do is we'll play some Sunny Aid, which is more on the traditional side of things anyway.
Okay.
Kashimuyu alata swe, adu mama dereke o, yalumo yalumo. Eje kama julo, doni mukulu muke. Ah, uye kama juli, doni mukulu muke. Ani uye kama shilo. Kashimuyu alata swe swe, Kashimuyu alata swe, adu mama deke o, yalumo yalumo,
mama deke o,
yalumo yalumo,
yeba,
yalumo yalumo, adu mama deke o, yalumo yalumo, yalumo yalumo, adu mama deke o, yalumo yalumo,
adu mama deke,
yalumo yalumo, adu mama deke.
Bodo jalo mo anoye, banka ti o bodo jalo mo anoye. Oti fuju ba mi wi lo fowo soro, oti fowo soro lo tun fuju ba mi wi oti daju pe.
Emi ni kan lo leye o iwa o le bo, emi ni kan lo le bo o iwa o le mo.
So, Daly, you were listening to... everybody was listening to Sonny Ed there, I think. But you were telling me about the poverty in Nigeria that you
see. Yeah, the poverty rate is, you know, is amazingly high, you understand? And it's not even just poverty, you know. There's security as well. There's no security, do you know what I mean? So people are suffering and there's no security as well.
So you were telling me on the way from the airport that you'd have to pay bribes and stuff.
Yeah, you have to pay bribes, you know, police, like just saying, you know, give us dollars. And I'll be like, you know, where I'm coming from, we don't spend dollars. So why should I give you dollars? Do you know what I mean? So it's corruption. That's what's killing the country, bribery and corruption.
And it's still strong.
It's very strong. You know, police everywhere. Mm-hmm. And these police, they actually ask you for money. Give us, you know... They just ask you for money for no reason. Mm-hmm. So,
and there's areas of Nigeria you can't go to. Like you were saying, you could stay in Ogun State or in Abuja.
Yeah, there are many places I couldn't go to because, you know, I was just so afraid. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't go to Lagos. I couldn't go to the north side, you know, maybe Kano, Kaduna, blah, blah, blah. You know, I couldn't go to many places because I was just so scared. Mm-hmm. So I have to hide myself, you know. Where I could go was limited. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. You wanted to say a few words about Kunle. Kunle is about to be deported, I think. Or
yeah, like, I just believe, you understand, what I'm trying to say is, you know, I'm a Nigerian, you understand what I'm saying? But the Irish government, they have to do, you know, their job as well, maybe by deporting somebody. But these people, it's got to start from the government. You see these people, the government, they don't like us as individuals. But when they see the government, let's say the president of Nigeria come to this country today, they are going to give this guy a big-time red carpet. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Why? But you don't like the common people. You don't like, you know, people like myself, people like Kunle. I just pity the guy because I imagine sending somebody back to that kind of country. You know, it's lost. Once he gets there, it's lost.
Yeah, well, certainly we'll be having another item later on in the programme about tourism and refugee status in Ireland as well, which is definitely it's worth looking into. But DJ Daly, or Y2K, thank you very much for joining us today.
No problem.
That's brilliant. Okay.
And thank you, Robbie. Yeah.
Thank you very much, man. Great stuff. Now we're going to a different part of Africa, which is probably light years away because it's such a diverse continent anyway. But we're going to Sudan, and I spoke with Maha Abdelrahman Al-Sheikh Al-Sharif, and she's a human rights worker in Sudan. And I asked her what was the group she worked for and what type of work they did.
I'm working with Sudan Social Development Organization. We have development project like Safe Drink Water, and we have a construction of a school, okay, and we have protection unit, yeah, and we have, of course, emergency unit that working with what is...
Can you tell us about the protection unit?
Okay, protection unit, precisely, we mean by protection, we mean human rights work, okay, and in protection unit we have legal aid, psychosocial work, and monitoring and documentation of events.
What's the justice system like in Sudan?
The justice system, we have the police, the attorney, and the court.
Is there real justice there? Can if for instance, okay, well, I think we'll talk about Darfur and what you've witnessed there, I suppose. And can you tell us what's going on in Darfur?
Now, in Darfur, we have 1,800,000 people, IDPs, who are settled in the camps, and 300,000 people in the IDP camps, in Chad, refuge in Chad, and mainly they are living in plastic sheets and depend mainly on the international aid.
There's the Janjaweed. Can you say some of the things that you've seen in Darfur?
Yes, mainly, first of all, I want to highlight that the reports that have been, the UN General Security Kofi Annan have established a community, inquiry community about what's going on in Darfur, 2004, and they approved something that a violation of human rights had been taking place in Darfur, killing civilians, forced disappearance, forced displacement, and gender-based violence. This thing had been approved by the reports. Okay.
the government is behind this, yeah?
Yeah, and they approve second thing that the government and the militia, where the Genjawid, are responsible of what is going on in Darfur, beside the rebel member.
Can you tell us some of the attacks on women? What happens or how systematic is it?
Yeah, it was a gender-based violence against women and a torture and arbitrary detention of men suspecting that they are a rebel member. A study of Darfur crisis must not be complete without highlighting the women, because women, they have been used as war weapons, and everybody now know that, and we must try to look at this carefully.
And this rape, for instance, is one tactic used by...
Yes, there is rape, but I want to add that not just rape, we must talk about abduction, we must talk about beating, about the... we have a domestic violence, because, you know, in case of war and this, all this are increased because the people are stressed enough. There is domestic violence, beating, and there's looting. There's many kind of exploitation happening in Darfur, not just rape. But rape was the worst one. I know, but we must highlight another thing that happened. And we face a problem that woman feels shame, and she didn't even talk that she had been raped. This is a problem for us in Darfur, because, you know, it is Arab culture, and they say that the honor of the family come from the woman respecting her body or something like that. And so women are afraid, in order that she fear from a scandal, and she say she prefer not to refer the case that she had been raped, in order to keep the honor of the family.
What can women do, or what can be done to try to get justice in Darfur, and let alone to stop the attacks on women?
Yes, we just think about legal aid. And when we talk about legal aid, I mean a legal center inside the camps where the woman was violated, and inside the camps. Legal aid centers inside the camps, where the woman can easily report to them, and where they can do the process of legal aid.
Is there any redress? For instance, if a woman makes a complaint, does it ever get to court?
No, until now there is no. And unfortunately, we have 20 cases in Darfur. They just take the court one. And one has been punished. Sorry for that. And there is no redress for women in Darfur in the case of rape. And we think to mobilize the law, to mobilize the organization, to try to make a campaign against the government to try to find a redress for the woman in this case. Yeah.
Can you tell us then, the SLA, the rebels, they also do this as well? Yeah.
Rape or something like that? No. But they are responsible, they say, therefore they are responsible for killing of civilian. Yeah. Cause of killing of civilian.
What is the rebellion about in Darfur? Do the SLA want independence, for instance, for Darfur?
No, they say that they want Darfur has been exploited, and they want their properties, and they have been the Darfurian has been expelled out from the authorities, and they are searching their rights on authority, on wealth. And they even ask in the Abuja peace negotiation that they want the deputy of the chairperson, yeah. President. Yeah. They still negotiate, because Abuja 7 was taking place now in Trablus, and they have demands, and they are negotiating now. And still now there is nothing new. We are waiting for Abuja 7.
And is the situation worse now? I know it was particularly bad in 2004.
Yeah.
But are things improving in Darfur?
Yes. As the response of the report of the UN Security General Kofi Annan, 2004, international pressure have taken place in Sudan. And so the number of killing of civilians, something like that, have now were decreased. A cause of the report that have international pressure,
yeah,
towards Sudan. Yeah.
There's still fighting going on, for instance, around the town of Golo in Darfur, and 7,000 African Union troops on the ground. But what do you think is needed, really? Would you welcome more UN intervention in Darfur?
Yes, we want more work. More work and more attention, you know. Because, you know, there is a really work, there is some organized work there, but we need more, because, you know, 1,808,000 IDPs is not a little number, it's a big number, and so we need to mobilize more organization or to work in this area in Darfur and try to expand their work.
Is there a case for saying that the government of Omar Hassan al-Bashir should be overthrown, because it's a dictatorship and it's not in the least democratic?
Yeah, He must, because if he want to change, that means he must begin from this area, because, first of all, because, you know, democratic society, I mean, when we talk about democracy, that means we talk about respecting the others. Because now in Darfur we are 565 tribes. And in the military empowerment, we cannot deal with this number of people unless we are democracy, and they feel that it's democracy and everyone was respected and everyone could get his right. And now, what is worse, that in the government, the rebel, the military government in Sudan, they are mainly Arabs. There's no many Africans, and you know Africans. Sudan is Africa country, and there is no African in the government. It's a problem for us. And so we must have democracy. We must have a representative of anybody in Sudan, south, north, in order to deal with this.
So in Darfur, for instance, the violence is largely racist, do you think?
Yes, against black people, yeah.
And tell me, is it safe for you to express your ideas about democracy in Khartoum or in Sudan?
No, it's not easy. It's not easy, but many people do. We do. All of us do, but it's not easy. You know, what's me, military force? It's not easy, but we must.
Do you get threats?
No. Yeah. I haven't been in prison. I haven't. But we are human rights defenders.
Which is very good. Have you heard reports of other people being imprisoned because of human rights stance?
Yes, we have our chairperson, even Mudawi Ibrahim Adam, have been for several times in prison just because he was human rights defender. But I know he was chairperson, he was supervising human rights work or protection work, but I know.
Amnesty International have highlighted a few cases over the years as well, but there's a guy called Al Turabi. Yeah. I think he's in prison now, is he?
Yeah, but Al Turabi was one of the members of the government, and he was being overthrown because there is an inter problem between them. I don't know what is it precisely, but he was not, because he was human rights defender.
Yeah. How do you think it's easy to establish a democracy and elections in Sudan?
No, it's not easy, because, you know, we since independence at 1956, we haven't seen democracy. For this long time, on long period, we have just two democracy government for eight years. And you can imagine, from 1956 until today, just we have 8 years of democracy in Sudan. We don't use the democracy in Sudan, really. But we try to find it. Because, you know, we are a tribal country. No way. We need democracy.
How do you think that can be established?
First of all, for me it is vague to imagine, because now we have interim government for 5 years after the peace agreement have been signed, okay? Yeah, in Ifasha, yeah, in Kenya. And so they say that we will move toward the democracy, and I don't know, everything for me seems to be vague, because really in the ground I haven't seen anything new, and everything. For that, we are just waiting how they could do this, how they say that we are going toward the democracy.
But you're hopeful.
But now they are too, the government are still military, and just the Southerners now have some of their rights in the government, and they are too, they didn't represent Sudan, and they are talking about democracy. And let's see, we can see after 5 years. Now we have 5 years of interim government.
Yeah. And there's people in the city of Port Sudan,
yeah,
as well. They want a share.
Yes. Now the Port Sudan become that you want our rights, and we see every part of Sudan have been. That mean we say that in Sudan we have marginal and main. Main is in centers, and all the west and the south are marginal, and so all of them have deprived rights that must search for.
I've heard, though, that because of oil, especially in the south of Sudan, that China is particularly interested in Sudan and is not necessarily interested in democracy.
Yes, we have oil. Even in South Darfur, we have oil. And so, let's go. And what was interesting, that the southern people have their right in terms of separation after this 5 years of interim government. They have a referendum that if they want to stay in Sudan or to be separated. Mm-hmm. And so we will wait and see. Until now, I don't know.
And you were making some comments as well when we were talking about oil, about the standard of living in Dublin compared to Khartoum.
It is expensive here.
And what about, like, you were talking about public transport and other things we take for granted.
Yeah, everything for me seems to be quite different. We don't use to.
Even the different types of coffee.
Everything here shocked me.
Even though we take for granted things like cafe mocha or cappuccino. In Khartoum, you don't really have that choice.
No. We have many new things. It's experience for me.
Do you have religious freedom in Sudan?
Yes, of course. This is the thing that we have, yes.
Even though it's a sort of an Islamist government, you still have your religious
freedom. Yes, we have. And it's good.
Very good. Maha, I can't really, unless you'd like to say anything else, I think that's...
Thanks a lot, thanks a lot for you.
Thank you very much.
I have another thing to say, and just good luck.
Okay, good luck to you. I don't know how to say thank you in anything but Arabic. What's your own language, by the way?
It's Arabic.
It is Arabic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Arabic and then English.
And English.
Ah, yeah.
Okay, very good.
So thank a lot for you.
Thank you very much.
And good luck.
101.6 Near FM, community radio as it should be.
And I'm Robbie Sinnott. This is Majority World, programme with social justice, global issues and all things multicultural. And coming up in the programme, we've got Breed Smith. She's going to be talking about where to for unionism. Unionism with the small u, I suppose. This is Irish trade unions after the Irish ferries dispute. And we'll also be speaking to Raj. But first we'll have a bit of music from a guy called Samuel Smith, who's now living in America. And Sam did a lot of music in Ireland in the 1990s. Well, here you go anyway, and this is great talent that was never really spotted.
So blues, I've nothing to say. your trusted old balloon had burst into pieces. Decipher the true facts of history, not the marriage of science and religion.
We've got to speak about an event that is happening on Saturday, and it's happening in the Central Hotel on Exchequer Street, and it's called After Irish Ferries, What Next for Unionism? And this is with a small U, and it's about trade unionism. And on the line, one of the organisers from the Socialist Workers' Party is Breed Smith. So very welcome for us, Breed.
Thanks.
And can you tell us a bit about
that? It's not next. What's next for unionism? It's what's next for trade unionism.
Trade unionism.
Right?
I'm sorry about that. Okay.
Yeah.
I suppose unionism in America means the same, but not in Ireland, obviously. But can you tell us then a bit about what's going to be going on Saturday?
Right. The first thing is that there's going to be a debate about the future of social partnership between Mick O'Reilly, who's the regional secretary of the Amalgamated Transport and General Workers Union, and a well-known opponent of the social partnership deals. And Jack O'Connor, the president of SIPTU, who's a proponent, in other words, he's in favour, very much in favour of the partnership deals. And SIPTU, the largest union in the country, just voted the other day to re-enter partnership talks. So there's quite a bit of controversy about that, even within the union itself. And the debate will centre around whether social partnership really delivers for working class people, even in terms of what Dave Begg calls the social issues, the non-pay issues, like housing, health, transport, infrastructure, care of the elderly, etc. And I'd be of the view that it doesn't, and that the profits that are being made in this country way outstrip what is being returned to working class people in terms of services and infrastructure, and also in terms of the pay that they get. The pay that they get is taken often very rapidly by taxes and double taxes, such as bin charges. So the debate will be around those issues, looking at the pros and cons.
And that debate starts at 11 o'clock.
Starts at 11 in the Central Hotel, Exchequer Street.
The registration is actually at 10:30 to 11, and you can get a cup of tea or coffee.
Yeah, just to give people a chance to chill out and relax and talk to each other, and then we get into the debate. And the two speakers, when they're finished, will be plenty of time for the people from the floor, shop stewards and other activists who will come along to the debate to contribute what they have to say about it.
And the results, just for anybody who doesn't know, Exchequer Street is just between Grafton Street and George's Street. So it's
Exactly. And George's Street is kind of a marker for it. There's a set of pedestrian lights on George's Street, and the Central Hotel is just around the corner from
it. Okay, that's brilliant. Okay, and what's the next debate then happening?
Well, then we break for lunch, and in the afternoon at 2:30, we're having a discussion about the future for under the Services Directive. Now, the title of it, I think, is Migrant Workers and the Services Directive. As people know, Charlie McCreevy's Service Directive is being hotly debated in Europe at the moment, and it's the sort of consequences like we saw in Irish Ferries, it'll have that sort of consequences for industry and for employees. So we've got an expert from, a legal expert from Northern Ireland who has studied the Service Directive and is kind of knows it inside out now, is going to talk about it, along with Tom Tully, the chief shop steward from Irish Ferries, that notorious dispute over the Christmas period where we saw thousands come onto the street to defend both the rights of workers, migrant workers in the country for decent rates of pay and conditions, but also to defend the jobs and services that we have in this country and to make sure that there's no race to the bottom, which is going to be a huge issue over the next period. And then along with them will be, I forget his name now, isn't that terrible? He's the chairperson of the Migrants' Rights Centre.
Okay.
And he'll be giving us a view into what conditions and pay are like for migrants in all the industries where they're heavily engaged at the moment.
Is that the final debate then of the evening?
No, it's not. That'll be kind of the main session of the afternoon, but then we'll wrap it up and kind of bring it together with a look at what is the future for unions and how do we get our union leaders to represent us properly. Because one of the big frustrations for trade union activists is that they may feel very, very often that they're not being listened to by the tops of the unions, by the very heavy bureaucracies that have developed over the last few decades. They don't really represent the interests or understand the feelings, the depth of feeling of the members on the shop floor.
There's a big pay differential, isn't there?
But I don't think that's just that alone doesn't explain why they're so out of touch. There's many other reasons. And also, the nearly 20 years of social partnership has knocked the stuffing out of shop floor organisation. I mean, shop stewards and local section committees play a very minuscule role now in representing their own members on the shop floor level, because everything is done through head office. You know, there's no such thing as submitting a local pay deal anymore. And in some ways, you can argue that has an advantage, but it certainly does disarm a whole generation of trade union activists from being able to know how to organise and how to respond on the shop floor level. That's on the one hand, but on the other hand, I was well impressed with the local organisation that went into turning out the numbers for the demonstration on December the 9th over Irish Ferries. That was mostly done by local shop stewards and activists on the ground rather than head office apparatus.
Are you of the view that there's something very undemocratic about the social partnership because, for instance, it takes away the rights of Parliament to be able to pass legislation on certain fronts?
No, I'm not. I wouldn't be of that view from the terms of the rights of Parliament. I think it's undemocratic insofar as it doesn't allow for a true reflection of the way the social partnership things are pushed through. It doesn't allow for a true reflection of how workers feel in certain industries. You take mandate trade union, for example. They represent shop and bar workers, 20,000 of them or something, and they have just pulled out of the social partnership talks. And one of the reasons is that even though for years and years and years mandates have been opposed to the social partnership agreements because it hasn't been delivering enough for shop workers. Shop workers in general are low paid and they haven't been able to get out of that that debt and be able to rise above it because social partnership has held them back. And they mandate members would vote consistently against going into social partnership. But because SIPTU as a bloc, being the biggest union in the country, would have a bloc vote in the ICTU overall voting on it, then the likes of Mandate, or indeed the CPSU, who represents low-paid civil servants, or the Nurses Union, although they may be against it, get pulled into it.
Now, this is called What Next for Trade Unionism? This is in the context of After Irish Ferries.
Yeah.
It could be said that the Irish Ferries wasn't exactly a victory because, I mean, it's just to postpone the inevitable and eventually they might go under a flag of convenience anyway, Irish Ferries. But what was the significance of the Irish Ferries dispute, in your opinion, then?
Well, I agree with you. Irish Ferries wasn't a victory, but neither was it a defeat for workers because that company is set out to really put its marker in terms of we're going to do this, you're going to accept our terms and conditions and that's it. And they were being totally inflexible about everything from the application of the minimum wage to not giving the workers time off, etc., and forcing the Irish workers out of the job to displace them with lower paid labour. Now, all along, SIPTU and particularly Paul Smith, the official who represented the workers, had said that the question of reflagging was not up for debate, that the Irish flag had to remain on Irish ferry ships, and that was how workers' rights and pay would be protected. And in the end of the day, workers have lost that one. But what they have won is that they have secured the minimum wage pay and the minimum standards of employment for 500 foreign workers that weren't even in their unions that they actually set out to fight for. And that's a big achievement in the face of an intransigent company who weren't willing to give a single thing and who were trying to set a standard for the future for all employers. And I think that was achieved not just alone by the magnificent display of courage of the ship's officers who blockaded themselves into the ships for a number of weeks, but most significantly by the hundreds of thousands of people who came onto the street to demand that there be a threshold of decency for Irish workers, that the minimum standards be applied.
What I always find, and there's the elephant in the room when unions have been talked about, is the black market. And a lot of workers, when they are exploited, are being exploited on the black market. So officially, the builders' wages went up 9% last year. But, I mean, a lot of builders would tell you that their wages didn't go up and a lot of them went down. And so what the black market, how can unions actually try to get around the whole idea of the black market?
Well, I think they should start fighting it. And there is a good example of one union who's in the throes of a struggle at the moment against it. And that and you don't just fight it by rhetoric and by coming out with statements and by sitting down with government for social partnership talks. You fight it by physically taking on sounds like a big scrap, but taking on in terms of industrial muscle the companies that are engaging in the practices on the black market or engaging in practices which drive down wages. You take, for example, the National Roads Authority. They're in the news all the time now because of stuff like tolling. But the National Roads Authority is responsible for many, many projects of building roads and tolls and bridges and tunnels and all sorts of stuff around the country at the moment. There's billions being spent on road infrastructure. And they contract out jobs to various different contractors who take on workers. And it has to be said that most of the workers are taken, that these contractors, they're not being directly employed by the NRA, but they are being contracted out through them. Are being taken on Polish workers, Chinese workers, etc., who will work for a lower rate of pay, who are being taken on at a lower rate of pay than your traditional Irish labourer or building worker has been.
And if this is now, done on the QT, the companies don't even have to pay PRSI.
Exactly, in many, many cases. Now, last week, the BATU union that represents building and allied trades picketed out the National Roads Authority's head office. And even to the point that they got solidarity from the NRA staff who didn't go into work. And they're making the point, look, deal with this. Stop the contractors paying below the minimum rates and the industry rates. Deal with this. The contractors are making vast profits, the builders, the developers. They're all making huge money. The money is coming from the Irish Exchequer to improve our infrastructure. Nobody's objecting to that, but the workers should be paid properly. And the union are insisting that the NRA are forced to deal with this and to insist that the contractors pay.
I'd like to introduce some objections to that and talk about the construction industry a little bit later, but I just want to first of all ask, how can a union like Mandate interfere with a pub, for instance, that's got all its staff ununionised and on the black market on the lowest possible wage? Or, for instance, the example with Irish Ferries, SIPTU, I don't know what they could do, but the Filipino woman being paid €1 an hour, that was last March. People have a short memory with such things. But, I mean, these things are going on all over the place in a lot of shops, a lot of pubs, or cleaning companies and all the rest of it. How can unions actually do this?
You're making the assumption... It might be widespread, but it's not everywhere. There's still 20,000 workers who are members of Mandate who work in shops and bars. And that's what you start with. You start with your strength. And, okay, if there's bars out there who have no union members at all, who employ all foreign labour without any trade union membership in this country, it's very difficult to deal with that. But there are many, many bars and many, many shops, and the big chains, particularly the stronger chains like Marks and Spencer's, Dunn's Stores, Arnott's, Cleary's, Switzer's, all of these shops are unionised. And one thing that can be done is to ensure that, first of all, the wages aren't driven down, but secondly, the vast profits that these retailers are making, and they are, people are in a consumer frenzy over the last while, and there's huge profits being made through retail outlets, that some of them profits are returned in a fair way back to the workers who work in them. So it's not like we're totally marginalised, that we have no industrial strength. Indeed, we have.
No, I was just pointing out, how can people actually reach into workplaces where there are no unions? And it's probably much easier, because them companies that are actually accepting unions are probably, definitely you can use your strength much more, but a vast majority, I would reckon a lot of shops out there just, it's a mandate of nothing, don't have a look in, and that's where the real problem is going on, and the cleaning companies and Irish Ferries, like that Filipino woman, are, you know, there's just so many examples.
Well,
of
I just remind you that
are.
That Filipino woman did win her rights, because the Irish Ferries workers at the time were unionised and stood up to management and insisted that she get paid properly. There were protests put on the ship and it was blockaded into the port. And she got, I don't know, was it €30,000 or something in back pay.
But I know, so for instance, musicians who work on such boats get the lowest, it's the lowest common denominator, basically, the lowest bidder wins.
Well, I mean, you can keep giving me examples of where unions have failed, but I'm trying to point out that unions do have a potential strength and that we've got to start using them.
Yeah.
And the purpose of our conference is to look at ways for activists, shop stewards and activists like myself, knowing that we have that strength collectively as workforce, how do we get our trade union leadership to acknowledge that and begin to utilise it and begin to improve conditions for workers in the country, and that's quite a battle. It's an ideological battle, but it also means we have to get organised. Yep. We have to have networks and we have to have links with each other, both within our own unions and across industry and across unions. And that's what this conference is hoping to establish, that out of it we'll get those links and networks, sure, and begin to push forward more radical ideas within the union, more proactive ideas, instead of sitting back and leaving it to discussions with government, that we actually intervene when bosses are trying to make fools of us and undermine us, like the building workers are doing, like the Irish Ferries workers did at the time. And I think that's what's required, is to strengthen up the rank and file and begin to reassert the idea that we have an ability to act, and also to recruit foreign workers. Foreign workers are a huge asset.
I want to actually just ask you about that, okay? Now, let's say that it says it's great for the economy and great for that the construction industry is out of control and all the rest. It's just building and building. Unions are very reluctant to ever question. For instance, the Prison Officers Union will never question the whole idea of prison, nor will the Miners Union question the whole idea of the environment. Or, you know, there's loads of examples how unions sometimes don't do things necessarily to the social benefit, but are insular and look for the self-interests of its own workers.
So how
can you counter that? So, like, the construction industry, for an example, you know, is there a way of making unions more democratic vis-a-vis the rest of society as well?
So what do you mean, that we should be saying there shouldn't be as much construction?
Well, it's not necessarily just a very good thing when until the whole country's grey. I know in Wexford, where I'm from originally, that is just there's non-stop construction everywhere, and it's not necessarily good to build for building's sake. I mean, because and you know that it's not the people who are driving this are speculators and all the rest anyway. So,
well, I mean, those are political questions, and I think unions should be political and should intervene in those debates, but. Those are really questions for political parties and political representation to take on, because, for example, building for building's sake, I totally disagree with, but there is a housing crisis in my own area of Ballyfermot. There are 7,000 people on the housing list, 7,000 families.
Yeah, but a lot of people have 3 and 4 houses, and some people have 130, and that's...
But that's a political question, that's what I say, and that's why I personally, I'm a socialist, and I advocate there should be more public housing and less housing for profit.
Mm-hmm. And that's doesn't mean you've got to build more houses, is it?
No, I think the houses that are being built should be built for public purposes, for social purposes, and take people off the housing list and give families a chance who can't afford what are so-called affordable housing starting at 200 grand. People just simply can't afford it. It's unrealistic. And there are many, many families living in overcrowded and awful conditions, living on top of each other, who need the homes, but social housing has been put entirely off the agenda, the political agenda of this government and of many parties who partake in this government, or not necessarily in the government, but in the Dáil. So I think that's a political question. I think the union should row in behind those political questions, as they say they are doing by entering partnership talks, but the partnership talks have not produced the political solutions in terms of health, housing, education, or looking after the aged in this country. Okay. It just hasn't happened.
And just to remind people that this conference goes on, it's after Irish Ferries, what next for trade unionism in Ireland, and it goes on from 10 o'clock until about 4 o'clock in the Central Hotel in Exchequer Street, just beside George's Street, and everybody's welcome. It's fiver in.
Yeah, okay. It's just to cover our costs, but people don't have to come for the whole day. They can come for bits of it and drop in and out or whatever, you know.
Brilliant. Okay, well, Breed Smith, thanks very much for speaking.
And thank you indeed.
Okay, and we'll now have a bit of music from Sardinia.
Mi torreteasamente su pasado, que mi tormenta su cora frigido, cuyo tempur de rosar fiorido, delizona. Delizona fiorina, troppo resta e sempre scolaro, e su mente pegnara palmo, e su mente questo c'era fiorino. Mentos que nadie está cantando, caso lo entiendo, caso lo entiendo, no me de dónde estaré ni la pena, verás que te toco en un banco, verás que nadie no me de dónde estaré ni la pena, verás que te toco en un banco, verás que nadie no me de dónde estaré ni la pena. Ven a escuchar un montón, ven a escuchar un montón. Ay, contraré, porque se pasaré a mar, pasaré a mar, cruzar tu monte, tal y de esa gran monte, mis fides, ven a escuchar un montón.
And we have on the line Raj, and Raj is from Bangladesh originally, and I don't know what sort of news you've got for us today, Raj, but it's either going to be very good or not so good. Can you tell us?
God, what do you want me to say, Robbie?
Okay, well, okay, tell us about the Tina G first.
Well, I was talking to the people in Tijikar today, and I'm sending a proposal for a documentary. Mm-hmm. So let's see how it goes. And my first documentary is coming out 2nd of March during the Shocks of Galaga.
Okay, and what does that concern, that documentary?
It's actually I made a demo CD before I go for the big project. And it's about Irish language, how people treated in Dublin. Basically, it was based in Dublin. And then I did a bit of thing in Glencolumbkill. That's actually my favorite Gaeltacht in Ireland.
Southwest Donegal.
Yeah. Many people in Ireland haven't got a clue that where is this village. It's a beautiful village, and I was offering people that Irish people buy properties every single part of the world, so I was telling them, then why don't you go and, create an economy in Glencolumbkill?
She had a bit of a quandary whether you were going to be allowed to stay in Ireland quite recently.
Yes, there is a thing going on. Actually, I applied for my business permit as an artist, which I'm not sure about the law, but what they did, they put my application as a business permission, and if you need a business permit, you need about 300,000 euros in your bank account to get it. So I have everything done, but the money, I think I have minus 300 in my bank account, so that's the problem.
What does this give you? Does this give you Irish citizenship, or leave to remain, or just business?
I'll get a permit for like 5 or 10 years. So I've been here like nearly 4 years now. So if I will able to stay a few more years, I'm entitled to get my residency here, which is like the citizenship.
I suppose some people might remember a Saudi businessman called Al Masri back in 1993. he got Irish passport because I think he paid several million for it, and that could be done. And there's some associates of a brutal Mexican president as well, who actually Salinas, who found it very easy to get residency in Ireland too. When you came to Ireland, it was business reasons, or was it just to travel the world?
Yeah, well, it was a bit of part of my traveling the world thing, but I managed to get a year visa that time. Then I renewed it for the next year, and the third year I applied for, I put my portfolios together, because I did a huge number of work last couple of years in Ireland. I mean, I'm a very strong member of Irish Sculptor Society, Visual Artists Ireland. Then I'm a very, Irish lingual activist, as you say.
So you got very much attached to Ireland. You probably feel quite Irish now, maybe.
I can tell you a little story. I was traveling from Northern Ireland with a friend of mine, a local friend, and the police in the border. They stopped me, and I didn't have my passport with me. But they asked my friend, so where are you from? And he said, Dublin. Where's your mate from? And he said, Dublin.
Dublin as well.
And I looked at the guy and said, what's the crack, man? You all right? And he said, okay, you guys can go.
Yeah, although that accent is disappearing, unfortunately. It's a great accent, too. But are you in much touch with what's happening in Bangladesh ever?
I hear that there was a bit of a political thing going on, but the election is coming, and as you see, my dad is with politics. And one of my two of my auntie and my uncle is doing the election. Well, so it's a bit of busy time, but there was a bit of bombing going on. I hear some radical Muslim people was doing some shit. Well, this is another reason I don't really want to live in there, because the amount of artwork I do, some of them has strong nudity involved. So I don't think Asia is a good place for me to do all the stuff. One thing I can tell you, Europe gave me freedom, mm-hmm. but didn't give me money.
Oh.
Asia gave me money, never gave me freedom.
So tell me though as well, they've got the Bangladesh National Party and the Awami League, and there's basically there's two personalities that drive Bangladeshi politics, which is Sheikh Yassin and Begum Khalida Zia. These are both daughters of two allies in the War of Independence in the early 70s. Well, basically, it's a mirror of Irish politics, the way Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were founded, like, I think, anyway.
Well, I see their politics is actually built on two parties there, and they started in the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I say same time, but both of them are corrupted. I mean, come on.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. It mirrors Irish politics.
The world is moving in the same way. When I was traveling around Asia is not poor. It's the government who wants to show Asia as a poor place. I mean, what's happening? I mean, if you look at the resource that Bangladesh has, I mean, if you talk about tourism, that they got the biggest sea beach in the world. They got the Royal Bengal Tiger. They got the biggest mangrove jungle in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But when you switch on the TV, what do you see?
Floods.
Poverty, this, that, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Because government want to prove that we are poor so that they can get money from the World Bank, they can get money from the EU, they can get... And like Europe is paying money, EU is paying money, I mean, World Bank is paying money, but this money is not going to the people who need it.
Yeah, because there is poverty in Bangladesh. 120 million people, and a vast majority are quite poor, I suppose. And a lot of them are trying to eke an existence on the Ganges, which regularly floods and stuff. But I just want to ask you finally, do you know about the Rapid Action Police Force?
My God, Rab.
This is
they don't talk, they just shoot people. Well, past few years, they were a bit successful, to be honest, because the people they killed, they were really, really like big-time drug dealers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not the answer. Killing people cannot be the answer.
But one of the opposition candidates was shot recently, and they actually, Rapid Action Police shot a witness. So
they're
taking out people. But actually, we've got to more or less finish here because just enough time for me to say to you, everybody, thank you very much, Faraj, for speaking. And thanks
no
very much
problem.
To
yeah,
Breed Smith.
It was always a big pleasure whenever you interview me. You ask me lots of interesting questions. So, yeah, it was a big pleasure.
And you always give interesting answers, and it's fantastic. And just enough to say to people that this program, Majority World, originally went out from 4:30 to 5:30 on a Thursday evening. You can hear us again from 9 o'clock till 10 o'clock on a Friday morning, and I'll probably still have a frog in my throat then when you do that. And you can email us on majorityworld@nearfm.ie. So from me, Robbie Sinnott, and thanks very much to John Doyle as usual for doing desk. Have a good one.
Community Radio for Northeast Dublin, Near FM 101.6.